You're talking so sweet, well, you needn't. You say you won't cheat, well, you needn't. You're tapping your feet, well, you needn't. It's over now.
And good afternoon, Richmond. You are listening to The Defenders Live, and I am your host, Anna Edwards, and today is Monday. Defenders Live is brought to you as a production of the Defenders for Freedom, Justice, and Equality, and you can learn more at defendersfje.org and defendersfje.blogspot.com. In addition, you can follow us on Facebook, and Defenders Live has its own Facebook page as well as its own blogspot. So that would be defendersliveradio.blogspot.com. So here we are. It's Monday. It's Defenders Live, and we've got a few things to cover. The last couple of weeks, actually, I think over the month of May in particular, I've had some really, really great interview experiences that have been pre-recorded and that we'll be playing for you in the next couple of weeks. If you were tuned in, you heard an interview in early May with Nasim Raqqa, who is a journalist from Portland, Oregon. And she wrote a book called The Crying Tree, which is a novel based on her experiences reporting on and talking to people involved in two state executions in the state of Oregon. And all of the issues and experiences and emotions that come out of an understanding of what it means to participate in the execution of a prisoner in our system. The next interview that I did was with a woman named Lois Levine, and she is a teacher, also living in Portland, Oregon, although she's originally from Long Island, New York. And she's written a book that was just released in May called The Secrets of Mary Bowser. And I was very much intrigued because it was actually Nasim Raqqa who told me about Lois Levine and this book. And this may end up being the year that Defenders does talk a little bit more about some of the writings that involve both issues of importance in terms of social justice and some of the historical stories, people, events that are relevant to Richmond, and then by virtue of their particular stories of relevance to the rest of the country. As usual, we want these things to have relevance to your daily lives. And so in one way or another, we will sort of try to make those connections for you and certainly are welcome to you helping us make those connections. So remember that you can always send us an email at defenderslivehost@gmail.com. That is a new email address for that. So defenderslivehost@gmail.com if you have comments that you'd like to make about the show and the topic that we're talking about. And as always, I ask that you be constructive and have a contributory mindset as opposed to, some of the harsher. Not that I have a problem with criticism. That's not the issue. I just like productive criticism, right? So I think that's what we all would like to have. So, The Secrets of Mary Bowser is was intriguing in its title. Certainly, if you are in any way versed in Richmond's Civil War history and African American history and the idea of spy rings or any of the nascent characters of our community back in those particular days, the name Mary Bowser might be familiar to you. She was a woman who had been freed. She was born enslaved into the household of the Van Loo family, which was a very prominent family in the city of Richmond, and was freed by Elizabeth Van Loo after the death of her father, who was apparently very explicit about not wanting to free slaves. And she was educated and living in Philadelphia, and she was recruited to come back during the Civil War to participate with Bette Van Loo in a spy ring that contributed some of the most important espionage information to the Union Army from the household of the president of the Confederacy, Jefferson Davis. So this is a very much a Richmond story, and it was very interesting to have a really good conversation with Ms. Levine about the writing of this story and what compelled her and how she sees it as important to the present day. So that interview will be coming to you next week and the following week. So it's a two-part interview, and I hope that you enjoy that, and I look forward to hearing from you about that. Today I want to focus on, you know, things that are coming up, some good things, you know, festivals and things like that that we have that play an important role in the sociocultural fabric of our city. But I also want to put a little more urgency on what's about to happen on Wednesday. And in order to do that, I'm going to read you a statement. And this is in reference to the case of Ashley Williams, and she is the mother who is in a very problematic place in the judicial system right now. And in order to explain it, I'm going to go ahead and just read this statement to you. The Coalition for Justice, the Virginia State Conference, NAACP, the Defenders for Freedom, Justice, and Equality, and the Alliance for Progressive Values express their joint concerns regarding the present status of the case of the Commonwealth versus Ashley Williams, which is pending in the Circuit Court of the City of Richmond. Our focus on this case is to assure that the presiding judge in the case protects Ms. Williams' Sixth Amendment right to be represented by counsel of her choice. We have been in touch with Ms. Williams and members of her family, and from these communications, Ms. Williams emphatically insists that she wants to be represented by attorney Pauline Ewald, who was her previous counsel before she was removed from the case by Chief Judge Richard D. Taylor, Jr., who until recently presided over the case. Judge Taylor held a hearing on March 9, 2011, to address a motion to withdraw filed by Ms. Devika Davis, Ms. Williams' court-appointed co-counsel, who Judge Nance previously appointed. At the hearing, Ms. Davis alleged that she and Ms. Ewald were having problems cooperating in defending Ms. Williams. Before ruling on the motion, Judge Taylor also put on the record that Ms. Ewald had also made misrepresentations to the court. At the close of the hearing, Judge Taylor removed Ms. Ewald as Ms. Williams' attorney. As Ms. Williams' sole counsel, Ms. Davis later recommended that Ms. Williams plead guilty, which she did. In a subsequent, at a subsequent presentence hearing, Ms. Davis again asked Judge Taylor to allow her to withdraw from the case because Ms. Williams wanted to withdraw her guilty plea. Ms. Williams also told Judge Taylor that she wanted Ms. Ewald to represent her. Judge Taylor granted Ms. Davis's motion to withdraw and appointed another attorney, Carrie Bowen, to represent Ms. Williams. Following the removal of Ms. Ewald, it is our understanding that Judge Taylor filed a complaint against Ms. Ewald with the Virginia State Bar. We are not aware of the substance of that complaint. Ms. Ewald then filed a motion to be allowed to represent Ms. Williams. Judge Taylor appropriately recused himself from Ms. Williams' case because of his outstanding bar complaint against Ms. Ewald. He stated in his recusal order that the case would be assigned to the next judge in rotation in Richmond Circuit Court. In recusing himself, Judge Taylor indicated that if the presiding judge denied Ms. Ewald motion, her motion to represent Ms. Williams, he would resume presiding over the case. The next judge in rotation was the Honorable Beverly W. Snuckles, who declined to preside over the case. The Honorable Margaret Spencer was next judge in the rotation, who agreed to preside over the case. Judge Spencer is in the process of scheduling dates and times to rule on Ms. Ewald's motion. We are concerned that since Judge Taylor is chief judge, that it would be inappropriate for Judge Spencer or any other judge in the Richmond Circuit Court to hear this case. We think that Canon 3E of the Canons of Judicial Conduct for the State of Virginia applies in this situation. This canon states, quote, "A judge shall perform the duties of judicial office impartially and diligently." Subsection E further states, quote, "A judge shall disqualify himself or herself in a proceeding in which the judge's impartiality might reasonably be questioned." We want to make it clear that we have no evidence, nor are we suggesting that Judge Spencer lacks impartiality in this case. However, we do find that her impartiality can be reasonably questioned because Judge Taylor, as chief judge, is in respect to the other judges in Richmond Circuit Court, primus inter pares, or first among equals. Consequently, we question the impartiality of any judge in the Richmond Circuit Court presiding over Ms. Williams' case. We feel that all of the judges in the Richmond Circuit Court should recuse themselves from the Williams case and that Judge Taylor make a request that the Supreme Court appoint a judge from another circuit or a retired judge to preside over this case. It is important that we reiterate that we express no opinion as to the guilt or innocence of Ms. Williams. Our only concern is that she receives a fair trial and that she be allowed to assert her presumption of innocence that the law gives to her and any other criminal defendant. Now, what I've just read, of course, as you could hear, is a statement an opinion statement by this grouping of organizations which has been following this case. The basis of the case is that Ms. Williams, as a result of pleading guilty under these circumstances, was found guilty of second-degree involuntary manslaughter and felony child abuse and neglect that apparently resulted in the death of her 2-year-old child. Now, she has other children who are healthy, who have since been removed from her care and put into foster care as a result of this conviction. However, the contention is that she pled guilty because she felt she had no other choice, not because she believed that she, not because she was actually guilty. And therefore, she never had an opportunity to actually present any evidence on her defense. And so that's really what this sort of centers on, is her ability to now reassert herself in order to actually have a trial where she has the opportunity to present defense material and evidence. So that's what this is about. And what makes this so urgent is the fact that if the judge does find that either Ms. Ewald cannot represent her or that when Ms. Ewald files for a new trial and is not granted a new trial, it does mean that Ms. Williams would go straight to sentencing, and she is facing the potential of anywhere from 5 to 40 years. And if you can imagine facing the possibility of 40 years in prison when it is likely that you are actually innocent and you never got a chance to present evidence in your own defense, I cannot fathom that. I cannot fathom what that must be like to live with. And this is where it is in our best interest to ensure that people who find themselves subject to an extraordinarily powerful and often arbitrary criminal justice system have people stand with them in defense of ensuring that the system works as well as it can, and when it doesn't, to push it to do so. So I hope that you will consider learning more about this case. And I wanted to further let people know that there is the hearing that we've been talking about is actually scheduled for this Wednesday morning at 11 o'clock. And we hope that people will consider attending in order to at least help demonstrate that Ms. Williams is not alone. And also, I think, again, what we're really trying to stress here is that she should not be isolated, but that this case is representative. None of these cases are entirely unique, and they do represent a dynamic that's faced in our court system on a routine basis. And so it bears you paying attention, and that is one of the reasons that Ms. Williams is also worth your attention. All right, so thanks for listening to that first part of the program. You are listening to The Defenders Live. I am your host, Anna Edwards. Defenders Live comes to you every Monday from 12 to 12:30 here on WRIR 97.3 LPFM. It's Richmond's radio for the rest of us, and we are delighted to be here with you on WRIR, where you can listen live to the show on Mondays at 12, but also we are streamed rebroadcast on Tuesdays, I believe at 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. And that's online only. So if you tune in by radio, you won't catch us on Tuesdays. But if you tune in via the website, you will. Today, I'm talking to you. This is one of the shows where I just get to talk to you and say what's on my mind about things that are happening around town. And we've just been talking about the Ashley Williams case, which is coming up for its hearing on Wednesday, June 13th. And it will be at room 302 in the John Marshall Courts Building, which is at 400 North 9th Street in downtown Richmond. The courthouse itself is just north of East Marshall Street behind the City Hall building. And if you're driving, come a little early because parking is often tight. So what else is happening? I like to talk about Juneteenth, because that's one of the things that is coming up. Today is June 11th, 2012, and on June 16th, the Olegba Folklore Society will be holding its annual Juneteenth celebration, and it's one of those events that we don't like to miss. She's got a lot going on, and the program this year is going to be very good. And but what I like about Juneteenth as a celebration is the way that it represents a sort of historical tendency that people have. When we want to find a way to commemorate something, we look back. We look back for a point of origin or a point that is compelling to us, that something that we feel emotionally carries what it is that we want to commemorate or celebrate or mourn. Or whatever that is. And Juneteenth is an interesting one because it belonged originally to the black folk of Texas back in 1865 when the Union Army sailed into Galveston in order to complete the liberation of the state of Texas from the grip of Civil War and from the Confederacy. That was the year when they found out that they had potentially been freed as early as 1863, January 1st, when the Emancipation Proclamation went into effect. Now, of course, if you read the Emancipation Proclamation document, you would realize that it did not, in fact, free people, or not that many people. It did, in fact, only free people where it could be enforced by the Union Army, and that was it. However, what becomes more important is that the passing of the Emancipation Proclamation resulted in a number of phenomenon that contributed to the accelerated demise of the Confederacy and the Civil War. And that was part of what became so important. One of those pieces, of course, I like to describe as a wave of self-emancipation. And part of that had to do with the fact that many of those many of the people who freed themselves or ran away, taking advantage of the opportunity to escape from enslavement and run north, also took the opportunity to enlist in the Union Army, thus fattening the ranks of the Union Army when it was in fact terribly, terribly depleted, not only by the casualties of battle, but also by disease. There were just, you know, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of soldiers on both sides that were wiped out by malnutrition and disease. And this mass exodus depleted the possibility of support, depleted the labor force of the South at a moment when they needed it the most in terms of momentum for carrying on the battle from the Confederate side, and at a point at which the Union Army needed it most as it was suffering from its own depletion. That makes it a pivotal moment in the Civil War and in the idea of emancipation and what that meant for enslaved black people at that time. Abraham Lincoln did not just free slaves, and he would say that this was not really about that, but rather than sort of trying to trek down the path of saying whether or not the Civil War was about slavery, which ultimately and fundamentally and ultimately it was, is really a more compelling notion that if you read the documents, if you actually sort of face the documentation, it lets you know what it's about, what states' rights was about. And but there is a component, of course, of that that goes to how we see ourselves and how we give ourselves an identity, how we align ourselves with an identity. And that's part of the history of this struggle. And it's part of the history of what Juneteenth means to people. Again, this reference, June 19th, 1865, when in the short version, black people found out that they were free, that the Civil War was over, and that they had, in effect, were supposed to have been free as of 2 years earlier. They began celebrating. And when they began celebrating, it took another 100 years, but in the last, I'd say, 25 to 30 years, Juneteenth celebrations have been springing up all over the country. And it has been a part of Richmond's makeup, I think, for the last 20 years. And it's a great opportunity to get a sense of what the history of Richmond is in relationship to slavery, to emancipation, to struggle for freedom, for justice, for equality. And that's a story that we all need to participate in. And so I hope that you will take advantage of the opportunities that are really popping up all over the place to do that in the city of Richmond. And then if you take that idea, if you take maybe a rising sense of participation in the idea of the struggle for liberation, I hope then that you will see the very sturdy bridge of connection between that and the case of Ashley Williams and so many others like her who are facing the end of their liberty at the hands of our criminal justice system. So again, I'd like to remind you in these closing minutes of the show of the date of her hearing. It is this Wednesday, June 13th. It's at 11 a.m. in room 302 of the John Marshall Courts building downtown, which is at 400 North 9th Street. And if you can be there to show your support for Ms. Williams' struggle for adequate representation for her case, I think you will find that that experience will move you, especially if you have not ever done such a thing before. It's really the best way to find out how our system works, is to be there, to witness it, and potentially find out how directly you can or have already been participating in it and see what all the hubbub is about, right? So the Juneteenth program is this weekend, June 15th and 16th. And then there's a whole slate of things that are coming up for the rest of the summer and the year that have reference to our history in Richmond, African-American history, but that connects to the history of Richmonders overall. So, you know, stand in another perspective and take the plunge. Visit Shaco Bottom. Visit the Richmond's African Burial Ground and the Lumpkins Jail site. Take the Trail of Enslaved Africans historical tour that you can actually take yourself because of the spectacular marker system that is now in place down there. Know that Richmond is a unique place where you can put your feet on history, that you can put your hands on the walls of history, that you can feel it living and breathing as you walk its streets, and that you can then learn from it and move us forward in a better way. I certainly hope so. Again, more information or reminders of the information that I've given you today, you can visit our website at defendersfje.org, defendersfje.blogspot.com, and defendersliveradio.blogspot.com. And if you have any questions, call 804-644-5834 or give us an email at defenderslivehost@gmail.com. That's defenderslivehost@gmail.com. I want to thank you for tuning in to Defenders Live today and giving me the opportunity to share my perspective with you on what goes in the city of Richmond. We'll be talking after the interviews with Lois Levine on the book, The Secrets of Mary Bowser. We'll come back to talking about what's coming up in Richmond, including our local elections, the national election, the work of the Black Left Unity Network, the Defenders for Freedom, Justice, and Equality, the Virginia Defender newspaper, and, of course, what's coming up on this show. Thanks again for tuning in. We will talk to you next week. Keep up the struggle. Remember that kindness matters. And have a spectacular summer. Thanks.
You're talking so sweet, well, you needn't. You say you won't cheat, well, you needn't. You're tapping your feet, well, you needn't. It's over now, it's over now.